In 1975, a young boy from Birmingham wrote a story for a Jackanory competition. It won and was read out on air, to the author's chagrin, by Kenneth Williams, not the actor he'd had in mind at all. He'd have preferred Spike Milligan. In 1996, an up-and-coming actor wrote and performed his first one-man show at the Edinburgh Festival. It's called Think No Evil of Us, My Life with Kenneth Williams. And he later took it to the King's Head in Islington, which is where I caught up with the show, and with him. The boy and the actor, one and the same person, is David Benson.
That was honestly brilliant. Thank you for letting us come and broadcast straight after a performance that you've just given, two hours.
Well, it's an hour and a half, and of course, if it goes very well, like it did tonight, then you don't feel tired, you feel elated, and I could do the show again quite happily. Mm. You know?
It's the adrenaline, isn't it? It gives you the energy.
Of course.
But I tell you,
it's also the energy you receive from the audience. Mm. Not just the audience, the energy you give out, but when you get it back, it's a wonderful reciprocation. And you get the energy of an entire room of people. Mm. It's coming in this wonderful circuit that links up, you know. It's a tremendous feeling. It's what I've wanted ever since I was a child.
What was?
Well, when I was about... my sister, I've got a twin sister, and she will tell you that when I was 5 or 6 years old, I would leap out from behind the curtains in the living room and go, "It's the David Benson Show!" And, of course, I knew then that I wanted to do it. I didn't have the script then, but I knew I wanted to do it.
But I found it... I mean, I... flattering you will get me nowhere, but I will tell you what I think. Right. I tell you, I do think you're a genius, what you did tonight. Oh. And it's extremely hard... Hmm. For somebody who was not there to know what you were doing.
Yes, it does depend very much on... It's not something that's easy to describe. If I told you that I do a show where I play bits of Kenneth Williams and then I break out and play myself and talk about my mother and do a bit from the headmaster, a scene from recreating the school assembly, it wouldn't sound like much, but somehow there's a great... it's that thing about energy, that relationship with the audience that makes it into a living moment.
Right, but it's called... Think No Evil of Us.
That's right.
My Life with Kenneth Williams. And My Life with Kenneth Williams.
My Life with Kenneth Williams.
Yes.
I always worry, whenever I do the show, I always think, are people going to be sitting there thinking, why is he talking about his mother? We've come to see a show about Kenneth Williams. What's he going on about his mother for? You know, but what I try and do is take them on a little journey, a little emotional journey with me, and hope that they will stay the course and not worry too much about why I'm not talking about or not being Kenneth Williams at that moment. And I don't think people go away thinking they haven't had enough Kenneth Williams, because... certainly by the end, they've had a lot of him. I do that long scene at the end where I'm doing him in the restaurant, and he's bellyaching away and flirting with the waiters and, you know, and all that.
He's grotesquely like him, you are.
Really, just like him. Well, you see, he's funny. The audience are laughing when I'm doing all that stuff and saying, yes, oh, this great queen came up to me, you did. Great queen came up to me outside Boots and said, you were so cruel to me. You were so cruel. I went home and cried my eyes out after what you said to me. I said to him, my dear fellow, I'm so sorry. I can't always be polite to everyone. You try and have a civil word for everyone, but you can't. Can't always have a civil word for everyone. Of course, what I wanted to say was, get your great ignorant face out of me. Go on, take your wig with you. Go on. So when I do all that, and of course they love all that, but it's grotesque as well. It's like him. It's funny, but that's what I'm trying to suggest in the play. I'm trying to suggest that his comedy was fueled by his own anger and his own hatred of himself and of other people, and the two were absolutely inextricable. That's why his comedy had that manic edge to it, didn't it? I mean, you often felt as well that he was being funny and didn't really understand why the audience was laughing, because he was actually trying to be serious. Mm. And they'd be tittering when he went, yes, what a good question. You know, some serious question about theology or something. Yes, what a good question. And people would immediately start tittering because they were thinking of the doctor in Carry On Doctor or something, Dr. Tinkle.
But when you're imitating him, it's not imitating quite. You're doing something else, aren't you?
I don't know what it is, to be honest. Somebody said to me it's like you're being inhabited by him, which I don't know if it is or not, but it's just you hear him in your head. This is what all imitation works, I think. You hear it in your head first, and then you just try and reproduce in your voice and in your face what you hear. I never do it in a mirror. Some people say, do you rehearse in a mirror? Never. Because I think you've become far too self-conscious. You have to. If it feels right, it will look right, and if it sounds right in your head, then it will sound right to an audience. So that's the way I work. So I don't know what you call it, really, but I'm in control of it, and I can slip in and out of it. But it's like getting into a state. where you just, you can let go. And if the audience accepts what you're doing.
But there's a story attached to why you wanted to do it, wasn't there? Why you've done this.
Well, yes, I decided that the time had come to do something of my own. And really, I didn't set out to write a show about Kenneth Williams. I just decided I wanted to do a one-man show about something, anything. Mm, I didn't know what. And so then I'd been doing The Voice for quite a few years. In fact, I started doing Kenneth Williams' voice after he died. It wasn't until then that I did it, because I was used to do readings at a bookshop I worked in Edinburgh, and he died, and somebody said, why don't you do a little tribute? He read your story on television. Do a little tribute for this reading. Do it for the Joe Wharton Diaries. And so I read this piece, which was a long quote from Kenneth, and there was an immediate recognition. I realised, with the audience, and I realised that I'd got the voice more or less right. And then it started to slip into my conversation, rather in the way that it did in his. You know, if he felt he wasn't getting enough attention at a dinner table, he would go, here, this is grace. I've never been so appallingly treated. And so I found myself doing the same thing. There's always a quick way of getting attention back to myself. And so that I was already doing it. And then, you see, I saw a programme about him on telly, late 94, documentary about him. And I just thought, that's it. That is the subject for my one-man show. It's the most obvious thing of all. Sometimes the thing you've been looking for, searching and searching for, is under your nose the whole time. And I thought, just do the most obvious thing. Just do what I do off stage, on stage. So I do the Kenneth. Obviously, it's more evolved. And I wrote a script, and I really did a lot of research into his life. I read the diaries and the letters and met friends of his and built up a picture of him that way. It's not a biography, you notice. I don't do biographical details. I don't set it in any time or place. It's a character study.
Yes, but do you think you understood that character? Because you've done him so well tonight. Mm. I met him, you know,
yes,
I interviewed him a couple of times.
I've seen your interviews with him.
And I think I know I am mentioned in his diaries.
Yes. There's one interview in particular that I remember that you did with him. Although you don't appear on the screen, but it's a clip I saw, but I know it was your interview because it just had that quality. And it was he was very, very old at the time for him. Of course, he was only 62 when he died, but he seemed a lot older. And he was very obviously very, very ill at that time. I don't know if you remember that interview. And I can't even remember what he was talking about, but it was one that very much stuck in my mind because he was being very serious at that point and talking in quite a low-key way. Mm. And he was obviously in great pain, which really I remembered, you know, very vividly. It's painful to watch his face. He looked so ill, you know.
Have you worked out what you seem to have worked out in this piece tonight, though? Is the guy's sort of strangeness?
Yes.
It's not to do with his homosexuality, his strangeness.
I don't know what it's to do with. I haven't worked it out, to be honest. I think there's a limit beyond which I can't go in figuring him out. I can only take things that I've learnt about him and present them, and it's up to the audience as well as me to try and figure out what that's all about. Mm. And people come to me and they say, yes, that was very interesting what you, that link you made with him and yourself or whatever. And I think, well, did I? Actually, I didn't. But people come back to you with things that they picked up that I didn't even think about. So I've never figured it. I can't think why he was so unhappy. I wish I knew.
Well, you say at the end he didn't like himself.
Yes.
And unless you like yourself,
yes,
nothing can happen, really.
You can't accept other people's love.
Exactly. And that is very, very lonely.
Yes, that's right, that's right.
That's so isolating, isn't it?
It is. I think it's a journey that we all have to make, is learning to love yourself and to accept yourself, your faults and your assets as what part of the whole package. And just as what, and that also is the same with other people's faults as well. And that's why I call the show Think No Evil of Us. It's partly because it appears in his letters as published. He will sometimes write a letter where he really berates one of his friends and says, why don't you ever write to me? You don't put enough details in your letters. I want to hear details, conversation, snippets. And then really horrible letters, and then he'll say, think no evil of us, Kenneth. I thought it was wonderful because so much of my show is about redemption. It's about seeing through people's bad points and friends, and that they're not evil, that we're all just frail human beings struggling along and trying to make the best of our lives and of ourselves.
But do you think you bring your mother in,
yeah,
to it? And your mother was obviously what? Is she schizophrenic or was she...
If you had to put a name to it, I suppose the label would have to be schizophrenic.
She might have been, mightn't she?
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
And as a child, that must have been extremely frightening to come across this...
Yes, it was. Of course, though, as a child, you accept whatever comes your way because you don't know anything different.
It was frightening, though, surely.
Yes, it was. Initially, it was terrifying when she would strike us for no reason or throw things at us or just accuse us of trying to kill her. But as we went on, as we got a bit older and we became stronger physically ourselves, it became absurd and it became embarrassing. And I think my loneliness, you know, I was very lonely as a child. I never used to like any of my school friends home. because I was just mortified by what would happen if my mother walked into the room. Mm. I mean, I do remember that when this story appeared on Jack and Nora, because I had this story that was on Jack and Nora, you see, that I wrote for a competition that Kenneth Williams read. Great high point in my life. And a man from the BBC came to do a little interview, and he came to record me reading my story, just in case. I think they... I don't know why they did that, but I think maybe they might want to use it or something. I don't know. Anyway, they did that, and here came this man who came all the way from London with a beard, and he sat down, and this was after school one day, and my mother walked into the room, and she said, "You're trying to kill me! You're trying to kill me! I wrote that story!" And she was going on like this and coming out. I was going, "Oh, get out! Go on, get out! Go on!" I just pushed her out of the room and then sat down and continued to read my story. And this poor man, the look on his face, you know, he just didn't know what to make of it. And I didn't know how to explain it to him. I just had to say, "Sorry about that," and just carry on. I had no words that would describe what was going on in my life. You
Until
know.
Then, she went, was taken away.
Yes.
In a straitjacket.
Well, more
almost.
Or less. Sedated, yes.
Sedated and taken away.
Yes.
She had not been classified as mad.
Well,
which would have been easier in a way for all of
yes,
you, wouldn't it?
It would. My father, who's a doctor, got 5 psychiatrists in to see her over the years, 2 of whom said she was mad, and the other 3 said she was just putting it on. So nothing was ever able to, weren't able to do anything for her. Mm. And so you had this absurd situation where she was just living, getting with us, getting madder and madder, more and more bizarre, these great wild adventures she'd have with often great sort of distinguished figures in Birmingham. She'd become obsessed with conductors of orchestras and things, and you know, you were just mortified by these things, you know. So I shut myself away, and my way of dealing with it was to live in a fantasy world. I think a lot of people do that. They just lock themselves away, and I lived in this fantasy world in my bedroom where I was obsessed with anyone who was funny. I liked all comedians. I loved Ronnie Barker. I loved people could do things with their voices. Peter Sellers, Ronnie Barker. I loved Kenneth, of course.
And then were you imitating them in your room?
Yes.
Did you do it in the show?
Yes. And I was doing it in my head, and I really would go to school talking like Sergeant Wilson. And go, "Oh, how awfully charming, very lovely, you know, very charming uniform, very attractive." All that, you know. And Wilson, and you know, Mannering, you know, Wilson, you know, all that stuff. And, "Oh, do be quiet, you silly little lad," you know, the vicar. I could do them all. And all sorts of weird people. I was obsessed with a lot of people at that time. Fred Astaire was one of my great obsessions. I saw this Fred Astaire movie when I was 13 and was instantly hooked. And I used to try and walk like Fred Astaire. I used to walk to school singing Night and Day. I was a very strange child. And
very strange. I did too, you know.
Did you?
Yes.
Were you reviled?
Too damn true. I could imitate quite well when I was a child, and I used to do things like
really?
That. Really? Oh.
Well, kindred spirits.
Yes.
Yes, we do.
Somewhere along
we know
the
what it's like, in a way. And you know, there are other people. I was quite unusual people. Jack Benny. I was a huge fan of Jack Benny, because when I was about 14, I saw this compilation of his on television, and I used to go, I'm doing all that Jack Benny stuff. I thought he was wonderful. Still do. All these people who I loved then, I still love. They've never gone away.
Did you do the real people of your life as well, though?
Why yes.
You,
yes. Oh, yes. That's
like
cool.
Your headmaster, that you do
yes.
Brilliantly, brilliantly in the show.
Yes. No, yes, I did. I think that, again, you find a lot of lonely children that get acceptance at school by doing imitations, by being funny. And I certainly only really learnt to cope with school when I realised that I could be funny and that I could get laughs, and it drew people to me. Whereas before I had been reviled. I was somewhat ostracised because, first of all, I spoke posh. I went to school in Birmingham. And everybody talked like that, you know, and I was going, not quite.
You were not.
But almost, as far as they was concerned.
Because you were a doctor's son.
I was a doctor's son. My father was not. Did not have a Birmingham accent, so neither did I. Mm. And so they would say, "Oh, he talks posh, he does, he's a snob." That's what they used to say. So I was instantly, the word go, I was an outsider at school. I always was. But then I remember getting my first laugh in class. I'll never forget it. It was as satisfying as getting the laughs out there tonight. Mm. That feeling of being suddenly accepted and realising that your hermit-like existence could come to an end if only you could perpetuate this ability to make people laugh. And that was that people love people who can make them laugh.
When you had your Jack and Nora story yeah. accepted, and then you had Kenneth Williams yeah. read it, you didn't want that because no. you wanted Spike Milligan to read it.
Ah, yes, I did. Spike Milligan. See, the Goon Show was my passion from about the age of 11. I had these old albums. And I used to do all the Goon Show voices at school. Of course, nobody else I was at school with knew who they were. They just thought I had spoken strange voices. But I could do them all. And so I wrote... I also... Not only did I speak like them, but I also wrote like them. I wrote like Milligan. And all the jokes that I put in my story were very Milligan-esque. I'm trying to think of one now. There's the bit where basically the story is about a...
It's a very good little story.
It's a nice little story. It's about a rag and bone man, a guy who runs a museum.
Yeah.
And he stops a rag and bone man in the street and buys him an Egyptian mummy off him, and just to get his museum going again, because it's fallen on hard times. And he gets the mummy home and undoes the case and opens it up, and the mummy looks at him and he says, the proprietor of the museum says, "Oh, an Egyptian mummy, it must be worth a fortune." And the mummy opens its eyes and goes, "Yes, I should think as that I am." And he says, "How ridiculous. An Egyptian mummy speaking with a German accent. I've never done anything ridiculous." Of course, I'm reading it now in the Kenneth Williams voice that he did. But in my day, I mean, when I was doing it, I've heard Spike Milligan doing it.
But you see, I don't know. I just felt that when I read your story on the programme, about Jack Norrie, and the moral of the story is always keep your mummy interested when being viewed in public.
Isn't that bizarre?
It's bizarre.
I don't know, isn't that? It seems strange now that always keep your mummy amused when being viewed in public. I mean, what a strange moral to have now when I look at it. I think, what on earth was I thinking of?
But it's to do with your mother. You've been ashamed of your mother and you didn't want her to be seen in public.
Yes.
Because of her actions, of her craziness.
I know, now it seems so obvious, but at the time it never even occurred to me.
I mean, no.
It's absolutely bizarre. I can't explain that, you know.
Now then, was this a troublesome time as well in terms of your sexuality?
Oh, God, yeah. Every waking minute was spent in struggling with the fact that I knew that my sexuality was going in the wrong way. Of course, it was in those days.
Going in the wrong way.
Well, I thought it was the wrong way. I was 13 years old, and I fancied my schoolmates, the boys in my class. And I fancied people on telly. I fancied Kevin Keegan, and I fancied my teachers, you know. And I thought...
Your headmaster.
Not the headmaster, no. Not that great cane of his. Oh, no. But it was, you know, you would sort of... Of course, you didn't think anything of it until my father gave us a book to read. You know, like a lot of parents, they can't bring themselves to tell you the facts of life, but they give you a book.
Anything.
Yes. And so he gave me this book called The Fundamentals of Sex. Have a read of that. And there, in a section at the back, in between necrophilia and bestiality, and a section on perversions, was homosexuality. And it said the way it said was some men will probably find in some time in their life that they will be approached by a homosexual. But you should not worry about this. You know, it's quite normal, and she'd tell them very politely to go away. And I thought, my God, this is me? This is what I'm turning into. And, you know, you'd see people like John Inman and Larry Grayson on television. You thought, oh, my God, if I give in to my sexuality, this is what I will become, a sad, queeny little figure of fun. I suppose Kenneth Williams came into that category as well, somewhat, because he was very camp. So at school, after the story was read on television, I was somewhat hounded. I was made to feel... I mean, they all used to come up to me and sort of going, "Oh, Ducky," you know, and flap their hands in my face, the limp wrist hand.
But they did. Do you think they suspected you? Well, by that time,
any child who is a lone wolf at school is automatically going to be called a puff or whatever. And if all schoolboys equate all schoolboys equate a solitary nature with homosexuality. So anyone who likes reading books and doesn't like playing football particularly and goes his own way is always called a puff. I don't know why, but schoolboys seem to pick on it very early. In my case, it was true, but I was not really ready to accept that to myself, let alone announce it to the world. So I was a bit mortified about Kenneth Williams reading my story because he was very camp, and I thought this won't do at all. I was very embarrassed about it, and I spent the next few years living it down.
Living that story down? And
no,
Kenneth Williams.
Living the connection with Kenneth Williams down. Yes.
But that very reading of that story probably drew you all along back to him.
It did.
To work out this strange creature. Working him out, are you working yourself out?
Well, in a way, when I read the diaries, I thought, I can understand his need for solitude, I can understand some of his insecurities. Not by any means, I can't really understand why they were so extreme, but I can understand some of it, you know. To be honest, I'm not sure about working out myself. I think I can see the faults, some of the faults that he made in his life. The fact that he never was able to really enjoy the wonderful things that came to him. The love that came to him from fans. I mean, he would just say, "Bagger off," when people came and tried to ask for his autograph on the street. Some people he would let in, but a lot of the time he would be foul to people. And I would never do that. Because to me, the whole reason for me doing a show like this is to try and meet everybody in the world before I die. You've only got one life. And, you know, you have to try and make the best of it. And I love people. I'm trying to draw people to me. I'm trying to escape from that bedroom that I was in as a child and into the world. It's still the same process going on. I'm trying to win love for myself. And that's why I'm very much myself in the show. I decided I couldn't just be Kenneth. I had to let people know who David Benson was as well, otherwise it was a waste of time. And it would beg the question, why is this man on stage being so obsessed with Kenneth Williams? What's the story? What's the link? I felt I had to divulge some of that, and that meant being totally honest about my life and the things that happened to me. And that meant explaining that when I was a child, my mother was going mad. We did things that were awful as well as children. We told her to get lost and hit her, and we just cut her out of our lives completely. We were glad when she was carted away and didn't want to know what happened to her.
You didn't see her for 5 years?
No,
you went to
I didn't. As far as I was concerned.
Did anybody visit her?
My brother did. My older brother did. He had sort of guilt, and he didn't have quite as bad a time as me and my twin sister did. My twin sister even now can't be around her because it's too painful to her. I've actually forced myself to make to redeem our relationship in some way, to try and find some salvation in it all. And now, I mean, I spoke to her this morning on the phone. She was very, very upbeat. She was great. She was lovely, and she's very proud. She knows I talk about her in the show. And at first she was mortified, and she said, oh, I can't remember doing all those things. I think you're making some of it up. And I said, well, I'm not, but don't worry about it, because, you know, we've come back together. I used to hate you, it's true. You know that I turned my back on you for a long time, but we've gone past that, and now I tell the audience that it wasn't your fault and that I do love you, and she accepts that.
David, if Kenneth Williams was on the cloud, looking down, which he fancied he might be, what would he think of your show?
I should think he'd say, bloody cheek! I've never been so insulted. But then I hope that he would look at it and say, well, he's trying to show me as I was. He's trying to show me as a whole human being who had problems, but also had wonderful qualities. And I must say that many of Kenneth's friends have been to see the show, many of them. And people who loved him dearly and who haven't spoken to the press about him, who are very protective of him, and they think it's a very good portrait, very true and fair. So I hope that he would see that what I've done is an act of love. It's not a hatchet job, and it's not taking liberties with him. It's trying to show him as a human being and try and show the audience how we're all human, and that there's some of him in all of us, and that we're all making that struggle to find out who we are and to be at peace with the world. And, you know, I hope that's what he would see.
He'd love the fact that you gave him a jolly big part as well, wouldn't he?
A jolly big part? Well, you got an excellent part, yes. You got lots of laughs tonight, Kenneth. Don't complain.
And so did I. I won't complain. I think
that's
good. Good.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed.
Think No Evil of Us, My Life with Kenneth Williams, written and performed by David Benson, begins a national tour to Theatre Royal, Bury St Edmunds on Wednesday, the 22nd of January. The tour continues until June.